Talk human. Boy. Elliot. Elliot.
E.T. isn't just the film of this summer. It's a film for many, many summers to come. Some have called it an instant classic, but it's more.
It was the best movie-making experience of my entire life.
With E.T., Steven Spielberg has given us a very human drama that takes us across the universe into a new realm of perception.
With E.T., I'm in a situation where the star of my movie never existed before 1980. He had to be created through artistry and imagination and technology. For him to come off and for him to succeed emotionally was, I think, if anything, the best part about E.T. for me as a movie maker, that we hopefully brought this off.
Words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. They slither wildly as they slip away across the universe. Pools of sorrow, waves of joy are drifting through my opened mind, possessing and caressing me.
Steve Spielberg.
And you thought I was exaggerating a few moments ago when I called this a Spielberg summer. You see, the biggest film of last summer is one of the biggest films of this summer. Steven Spielberg's Raiders of the Lost Ark. It was a bold gamble, and it paid off. Big. In one recent week, the re-release of Raiders was the number two film at the box office. Number one, E.T. The irony is that when Steven Spielberg and Star Wars creator George Lucas first approached Hollywood's leading movie moguls with Raiders of the Lost Ark, they were greeted like Raiders of the Lost Art.
They researched, people didn't know what to make of it, and they thought it was science fiction when they saw George and my name. But when they realized, when they were told it wasn't science fiction, they said, gee, an adventure where the bad guys are the Nazis, and it's kind of like archaeology, and it takes place in the desert, and there's old cars and old costumes. I don't know. It doesn't sound like what I want to do this summer.
But going to see Raiders is precisely what a lot of people want to do in the summer. Why? Well, it captures the edge-of-your-seat, seat-of-your-pants kind of adventure that's been missing since the demise of Saturday serials. And maybe it's just because these times demand the old-fashioned type of hero played by Harrison Ford, Indiana Jones.
And then along came Jones. Talking Jones. Slow-walking Jones.
Slow-talking Jones.
Along came lonely Maggie Jones.
Indiana Jones is an archaeologist. In his spare time, he's a grave robber.
Give me the whip. Throw me the idol. No time to argue. Throw me the idol. I throw you the whip. Give me the whip.
Adios, señor.
And if you enjoyed watching Harrison Ford get knocked around by an army of evildoers in Raiders of the Lost Ark, then you probably love seeing him bashed about by six ruthless renegade replicants this summer in Blade Runner.
A Blade Runner's job is to hunt down replicants, manufactured humans you can't tell from the real thing. There was just one outfit making replicants that superhuman, the Terrell Corporation. I was looking for six replicants in a city of 106 million people.
Harrison Ford.
I used to think that Raiders was the hardest job I ever had until I did Blade Runner. It was constantly uncomfortable. It wasn't so much physically demanding as it was constantly uncomfortable, drenched in rain and stuff like that, covered with blood and mud.
Blade Runner is set in Los Angeles in the year 2019. And if you think the pollution there is bad now, then wait till you see the movie. Harrison Ford plays Deckard, a futuristic detective. But in truth, his style recalls the bogey-era private eyes of the 40s.
I met her at the Terrell Corporation. You know, the big boys in genetic engineering. They manufacture humans. Hell, they're so human you can't tell them from the real thing. And that's a problem. A big problem.
A Blade Runner is a member of a select police unit responsible for the control of and keeping track of a group of replicants, or the outlaw replicants. The premise here is that in whatever period of time, 40 years in the future from now, the science of genetic engineering will advance to the state where flesh culture replicants, reproductions of human beings, could be grown in the laboratory to full maturity. Well, I don't want to say too much. Suffice it to say that my job is to, it's a policeman's job of finding law violators. They've broken out of their slave shackles. They have been created. It's been a race, a breed created for manual labor, basically. And they have broken out of their off-world colony and have come back to Earth.
And from the future world of 2019, we travel to the future world of 1982 with Clint Eastwood. Summer wouldn't be summer without a movie from Clint, and this year he's given us Firefox, an espionage thriller. Clint plays Mitchell Gant, a man whose mission is to steal an experimental Russian supersonic plane that flies by thought control. The plot of Firefox has more twists than a pretzel designed by a committee.
Right, there are a lot of twists to it, but if a person doesn't give up hope, there'll be a certain amount of action will appear later on. I think movies are built for action because they have you can do the physical movement and you can take them anywhere and shoot them anywhere.
Mitchell Gant.
Great mother of God, he's done!
I'm speaking to the individual who has stolen the property of the USSR.
So we're getting the royal treatment.
You will not, of course, make it to wherever you are going.
I don't know what it is, but I'm a sitting duck.
We have done it. We have brought down the American.
Well, that's it. We might as well all go.
We don't know.
The hell we don't know. They got him, Aubrey.
I don't know. That could mean they didn't get him. That could mean they didn't get him. That could mean they didn't get him.
The computer system in that Russian jet in Firefox was pretty advanced, but it wasn't nearly as treacherous as the MCP, the master control program that swallowed up Jeff Bridges this summer in Tron.
Hey, 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 it's the big master control program everybody's been talking about.
Remember the time we just spent playing chess together? That isn't going to do you any good, Flynn. I'm afraid. Stop. Please. You realize I can't allow this.
How are you going to run the universe if you can't even answer a few unsolvable problems? Huh? Come on, big fella. Let's see what you got.
I'd like to go against you and see what you're made of.
You know, you don't look a thing like your pictures.
I'm warning you. You're entering a big era, Flynn. I'm going to have to put you on the game, Flynn.
Games? You want games? I'll give you games.
Critics have universally hailed the new universe of computer animation displayed in Tron, while social thinkers have pondered the film's theme that our alter egos might coexist within a computer. Sound far-fetched? Not to Tron creator and director Steven Lisberger.
Each of us is in this electronic dimension in one form or another. I mean, whether it's through your driver's license or your tax forms or your Blue Cross or your school records, there's some information of you that is already existing in the electronic world. What we tried to present in the film is that for each of us, there is a computer program, a body of information, if you will, who's in there. And what happens in the story is that Flynn, who tries to take on the NCOM computer system, which he thinks has stolen one of his programs, finds himself digitized by their laser equipment, scanned down into the video games he's invented, and he has to play them from the inside. And he has certain magical powers now because of the fact that he knows these games. But what's really amazing is that he runs into the counterpart programs of his friends in the real world and forms new friendships with them. And since he knows their users, that is the real people from the real world on the other side, he sort of knows what their goals are as computer programs. And through their combined efforts, they manage to change the system from the inside.
Hey, who's that guy?
That's Tron. He fights for the users.
Robin Williams, Henry Winkler, Burt Reynolds, Dolly Parton, and more. All coming up when The Source Summer Cinema Spectacular featuring an officer and a gentleman returns.
In a career that took him from Indiana farm boy to international legend in 5 years, James Dean made films nobody else could, lived a little harder than most people would, and wore his Levi's original blue jeans to places a lot of people probably thought he shouldn't. Since then, we've kind of redefined the word jeans, if not the man who wears them.
Levi's Movin' On Jeans.
Today, there are Levi's Movin' On Jeans, and new fabrics from the lightest cotton sheeting to the richest corduroy, new reverse silhouettes, styles you might not even call jeans, and colors that aren't even blue. We call these new Levi's jeans Moving On because we figure the guy who wears them is in a bit more of a hurry.
Levi's Moving On Jeans. Levi's, the legend is on.
Be all that you can be. Oh yeah. Keep on reaching.
Now you and four friends who join the Army together can live, work, and see Europe together. We'll guarantee it.
Be all that you can be.
See your Army recruiter today.
'Cause we need you in the Army.
Paid for by the U.S. Army.
The international struggles of our world may lead to
nuclear holocaust.
To survive, you must have protection from radioactive fallout.
In the past, heavy equipment necessitated a long, costly operation for out-of-home shelter installation.
Today, Survive All basement-type shelters offer a combination steel and concrete do-it-yourself fallout shelter.
Civil defense approved, Survive All offers maximum protection from fallout and falling debris, plus a basic equipment kit for family survival.
There's low initial cost and FHA approval. Nothing down in 5 years to pay.
For your family's protection, see a Survive All shelter today.
I'm Sarah, and this is my story.
I'm Ellen, and this is my story. One night, I was at a bar.
I was having fun with my friends. I had one too many drinks. I got behind the wheel to go home.
I got a cab to go home.
All of a sudden, from out of nowhere, a squirrel ran across the road. It happened so quickly, I barely had time to react.
The cabbie barely had time to react.
I swerved.
The cab swerved.
I can't believe it. I hit a guy.
I cannot believe it. The cabbie just missed a guy.
I wish I took a cab.
Thank goodness I took a cab.
You have the choice to save a life. Don't drive buzzed. It's a decision you'll never regret. Buzzed driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the Department of Transportation and the Ad Council.
WMFO Medford, it is time travel. I am Derek Gary sitting in for Chris Earl, and I don't know why I can't hear myself. There we go. That's much better. It is WMFO Medford. The big picture is coming your way at 7 o'clock tonight. Shay Spillane and myself will be here to catch you up on everything that's going on. But before then, we have some more of the Source Summer Cinema Spectacular to get through. And I'm going to raise the stakes on this. When I introduced this earlier, I said that one of your five favorite movies of all time is probably going to be mentioned on this. I'm going to kick that up. I'm going to say one of your three favorite movies of all time is going to be mentioned in this. That's how big the summer of 1982 was. And, of course, we heard about Poltergeist earlier on. Tobe Hooper passed away on Monday at the age of 74. Whether it was Poltergeist or a Texas Chainsaw Massacre, that guy scared the wits out of you at some point in your life. And just recently, we heard a little bit about Blade Runner. And of course, 35 years later, we have the Blade Runner sequel coming out in just a few weeks. I know I can't wait for that. Too bad we don't have John Leder and everybody from the Source Summer Cinema Spectacular to get us caught up on that movie. But hey, we got YouTube now, so we can watch the trailers. So let's head back into 1982. And in the second half of this, we're going to get into some of the movies that weren't quite as big of hits, but we still remember them fondly. This is WMFO Medford.
You are live on channel 44,000. Please do not swear.
Robin Williams, the master of improvisation. Before this summer, Robin was best known for his madcap portrayal of Mork from Ork. We're so used to seeing Robin clowning around that absolutely no one was prepared for the broad range of emotions he exhibited from agony to ecstasy as T.S. Garp.
My name is T.S. Garp.
What's T.S. stand for?
Terribly sexy. I used to be terribly shy, but I changed.
In The World According to Garp, the movie is based on the book of the same name, a book which the experts doubted could ever be translated to the screen. If I told you the plot, you wouldn't believe me, but what's helped make Garp such a summertime hit is the way in which director George Roy Hill channeled the ceaseless creative energy flowing from Robin Williams.
The first day on the set, I tried to improvise, and he said, "That's a wrap." I went, "You made your point." I mean, it was immediately made known to me that that wasn't what we needed. And you had to really play moments with people where you had, where improvisation would sometimes, you could be easy for me to duck out, going, "Oh, look over there, little flower." But then actually forced to have contact with people, and in the painful scenes especially.
Oh, don't cry. I'm the one who's supposed to be crying.
I gotta do everything around here. I gotta cook, I gotta clean, I gotta cry.
It's a man's life, but a very bizarre man. Emotional, very human, you know, very warm. You know, he's very sensitive. But he's also very, you know, very deep. You know, to get all those different levels is very hard, too.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Every summer has its sleeper movie, a small film that starts out slowly and then surprises everyone by building up a massive, loyal following. Dun, 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 dun. This summer's sleeper is a motion picture set in Baltimore during the last week of 1959, Diner. On the surface, Diner seems to be about a bunch of guys sitting around telling funny stories.
Hey, did I tell you guys that I got a date with Carol Heathrow tomorrow night?
Heathrow's cold.
You want to bet that she goes for my on a first date?
The only hand on your is going to be your own.
You want to bet me? Huh? Want to bet me 20?
You got it. But we need validation for this.
All right, I'll arrange.
How? What, are you going to get fingerprints? I'm telling you, I'm not going to do the dusting, right?
But Diner is more, much more. It's a slice of life set in the twilight of an innocent age, the 50s, right on the precipice of an unsettling yet exhilarating decade, the 60s. diner director and creator, Barry Levinson.
Well, it's our own private little haven. I mean, it's where you go. I mean, it is like a male club.
You remember that time when they brought a girl in here?
When was that?
What happened?
The only girl to ever set foot
in a girl in there.
It's the rallying place.
If you want to talk, you always got the guys at the diner. You don't need a girl if you want to talk.
Eddie, he'll never change.
They'll always meet one another there. Even if they go off on their separate dates or whatever, when they drop off their dates, they're going to get back together in the diner.
It'd be so cool to be older and hang out here, and now
we're, cool. We're older and we're cooler and we're still hanging out here.
Yeah. It's a place for them to discuss all their kinds of, like, you know, problems, criticize one another, and joke about things.
Let me ask you something personal.
Sure.
Is it true that you took out Arlene Standenberg?
You heard that?
Took her out?
Yeah.
Get out of here. Of course not.
And that is their sanctuary.
Always got the diner.
Yeah. We always got the diner.
In addition to Diner, there are a couple of other summer movies which are also sleepers. Sleepers in a far different sense. One is a tale about a couple of working stiffs who turn the New York City morgue into a place that people are just dying to get into. Night Shift.
Pimps? Are you saying we should become pimps?
Love brokers!
Now, movie reviewers tell us that Night Shift is like a screwball comedy of the 30s updated for the 80s. But the big shocker is that it's from two of the most wholesome, clean-cut all-Americans that television has ever produced, Henry Winkler and Ron Howard.
Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days. Thursday, Friday, happy days. The weekend comes, my cycle hums, ready to race to you.
Henry and Ron have made the transition from happy days to shifty nights with remarkable ease. In Night Shift, Winkler plays a man who is definitely not the mirror image of Fonzie. Chuck Lumley, a mild-mannered morgue manager. And speaking of image, Henry believes Night Shift will only enhance his.
No, it doesn't matter. You know, the fact of the matter is that when I'm doing Happy Days, it is as easy to be responsible to the young people that watch the show as it is not. When you make a movie and it has an R rating, you cannot be concerned so much about that whole line of thinking, you know? Otherwise, I would be totally stifled as an actor, totally stifled as a performer. My responsibility on Happy Days is one thing. My responsibility as an actor and to myself is a totally other thing outside of Happy Days. And there is nothing in this film to be ashamed of, because the women, scantily clad and sometimes totally unclad women in our movie, are there, and I can't wait to see them again. No.
Did you ever audition breasts?
That's Ron Howard, the former child actor who used to play Opie and Richie Cunningham.
Brian Grazer, the producer, and I, on one particular joke, a sight gag in the picture, felt that it was real important that the breasts look good. You had to say, oh, nice breasts. We didn't really know how to deal with that. The casting lady said, well, what you do is you bring them in and you look at them.
Bring them in and look at them?
Oh my God. She said, no, come in this afternoon and there are women who are willing to take the top off. And if they're willing to do it on film, they're willing to do it for an audition. As long as it's done tastefully and I'm there and so forth. And that's what we did. We spent an afternoon. Women would kind of raise their blouse just to the point where we could make a quick judgment. And we'd say, okay, that's fine. Very nice. And that's the way we dealt with that. And it still makes me a little red-faced just to think about it.
Obviously, Ron's grown up. And today, he's the man who directed one of his best friends, Henry Winkler, in Night Shift.
Henry had always said, one day you'll direct me. And I always thought of it as being 20 years down the road, you know. So when he said yes, when I came to him with the offer for Night Shift, I was really thrilled.
As we sit here and idly chat, there are women rolling around in strange beds with strange men, and we are making money from that.
Is this a great country or what?
City slickers down at the morgue weren't the only ones having a little illicit fun this summer. They were also doing it Texas style, with Burt Reynolds and Dolly Parton.
Let's just hope some of me rubs off and you'll be fair-skinned in this picture.
I might be big-breasted, too.
Starring in The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas.
Texas has a whorehouse in it.
Lord have mercy on our souls.
Texas has a whorehouse in it.
Lord have mercy on our souls.
It's the true story of the girls down at the Chicken Ranch and their mother hen, Dolly Parton. The sheriff who protects them, Burt Reynolds, and the newsman who busts them, Dom DeLuise. Dolly took the role because it's first and foremost a musical.
I think I know what my audience wants from me now that we have gone through all these things together. And I depend on the audience a lot. And the songs in this movie are more me, more of what I have been trying to do, all the routes I've had to take to try to get to a place to where my music, the simple version of my music, the country flavor of my music, would be accepted by a broad audience.
Strangely enough, the reason that Burt Reynolds took the role in The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas was also because it was a musical.
The real enticement was Dolly, first, and secondly, secretly a chance to sing, I don't know, and see if I could bring it off.
I like fancy, frilly things, high-heeled shoes and diamond rings, ragtime bands and western swing and sneaking around with you.
Well, I like beer and rodeos, detective books and dominoes, football games and Cheerios, and sneaking around with you.
The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas represents one sort of male fantasy. Another, spending the summer in the Greek islands with two beautiful young ladies who are madly in love with you. That's the idyllic premise of a beautifully photographed new movie from Randall Kleiser, director of Grease and the Blue Lagoon, Summer Lovers. It's one picture that's packed with summer love and great music from groups like Chicago. There's another movie out this season that's also about summer lovers. It's An Officer and a Gentleman, and it stars Richard Gere and Deborah Winger. We'll examine it in detail when The Source Summer Cinema Spectacular heads back your way.
In the last known photograph of the Dalton gang, Bob and Grat Dalton are both wearing Levi's original blue jeans. We'd like to think they gave their choice a lot of thought. After all, there wasn't a more honest, hard-working pair of jeans a man could wear. And there wasn't any place in the state of Oklahoma you couldn't wear them. But the Daltons probably had other things on their mind. 100 years later, we're still giving you a lot not to think about. Like no-nonsense workmanship that'll never let you down. Comfort you know you can count on. And style that fits in without question. Whether you're into state-of-the-art, state college, or just the state of Oklahoma. Levi's jeans. The more you think about them, the more you realize you don't have to.
Levi's, the legend lives on. Levi's, the legend lives on.
Ladies and gentlemen, we finally caught up with Murphy, the man who discovered Murphy's Law. And here's Murphy
Anything
now.
Anything that can go wrong will go wrong. Look at this.
Out of gas, Murph?
Nope. Got a full tank.
Then why are you pushing your truck?
Hey, gas is expensive. I don't start this guzzler any more than I have to.
What you need is a Toyota truck.
Huh?
Toyota trucks get good mileage.
Oh.
32 EPA estimated highway MPG.
Wow.
25 EPA estimated MPG. Remember, use this 25 EPA estimated MPG for comparisons of other trucks with manual transmission. The actual mileage you get may be different. Actual highway mileage will probably be less than the EPA highway estimate.
Toyota.
With a powerful 2.4-liter engine. And a price you can handle.
Okay.
Gonna buy a Toyota truck, Murph?
Sure am. I'm tired of pushing this thing.
Drive a high-mileage Toyota truck and watch things go right for a change.
Oh, 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 what a feeling. Quality Toyota.
And now, on to our main feature on the Source Summer Cinema Spectacular, An Officer and a Gentleman. Each summer has its military movie. In 1980, Goldie Hawn portrayed an overprivileged princess who would survive boot camp and make her country proud, Private Benjamin. And just last year, Bill Murray starred in a movie that turned basic training into basic hilarity, Stripes. But it's 1982, and what a difference a year makes. The Difference is a film that takes place at a Naval Aviation Officer Candidate School in Port Townsend, Washington. Sure, it's got a hard-as-nails drill instructor making men out of green recruits.
You ready to quit now, Mayo? Listen!
But it's much more. A tender love story, a lighthearted comedy, a lesson in life. It's the story of a young man becoming a real man, as Richard Gere becomes...
I like a man in a uniform, you know?
An officer and a gentleman.
What I liked about it, it was about people, it was about how they relate to each other, how they do not relate to each other, how they misunderstand each other, confuse each other, how they don't understand themselves and therefore screw up other people's lives or help other people's lives. It's about people bouncing off of each other. The microcosm of 12 weeks in this camp pressurizes everything and makes highly dramatic things possible.
We usually think of Richard Gere as a male sex symbol. That's because of his work in Days of Heaven, looking for Mr. Goodbar in American Gigolo. But as aspiring air ace Zach Mayo in An Officer and a Gentleman, Richard is subjected to humiliation, abuse, and physical exhaustion at the hands of his drill instructor.
I expect to lose half of you before I'm finished. I will use every means necessary, fair and unfair, to trip you up, to expose your weaknesses as a potential aviator and as a human being. Understand?
Yes, sir!
Price at the other end, flight education worth $1 million. First, you got to get past me.
No more, Mr. Nice Guy.
That's Sergeant Emil Foley, a man nobody would ever mistake for Mr. Nice Guy. Sergeant Foley is played by Lou Gossett Jr. His mission? To turn Zach, a know-it-all son of a sailor, into a man who knows he doesn't know it all.
I saw the quality in Zach of a leader, potential leader, but somebody who'd been on the underside of the world, if you want to call it that, and he is looking out for himself, and he would sell his F-14 one day to the Cubans if I don't break that particular thing without breaking his spirit. So that's the result of that weekend of hazing, if you want to call it that. And out of it comes a real, true man.
I done some checking. I looked through your files. I know about your mama. You don't eyeball me. You know your father's an alcoholic and a hole chaser. That's why you don't mesh, Mayo. Because deep down inside, don't you eyeball me. Deep down inside, you know that all these other boys and girls are better than you are. Isn't that right, Mayo? Huh? Isn't that right? No, sir! No, sir!
Richard Gere.
And D.I. really is a very strong, godlike father surrogate who one hates and loves and all those things. You want to kill him, you want him to hold you, you want him to tell you you're all right. I mean, it's like you want everything from this guy to define you. This pressurization of the 12 weeks intensifies all that. The fact that the guys don't get any sleep, they're totally exhausted all the time, and again, intensifies all of these feelings.
The reason the officer candidates willingly endure such torture is their desperate desire to pilot naval jets. Now, if An Officer and a Gentleman had been shot in the 50s, the training class would have been an all-male preserve. But this is the 80s, and one of the candidates is a woman, Casey Seeger, played by Lisa Eilbacher. Like Richard Gere's character, she's also trying to break away from forces that are attempting to keep her grounded. Casey's as tough as any man. Her only obstacle, the obstacle course, and the wall.
Well, what happened was we walked onto the obstacle course, and it was the last thing on this obstacle course that was built was the wall. So I kept going down there while we were rehearsing. I wanted to see this wall, I wanted to see how big it was. And we got down there, we were shooting that day. And he said, what do you think? And I panicked. You know, I'm very athletic. I didn't think there'd be a problem. And actually getting over it one or two times is no big deal. but shooting, you know, 30 different angles and 30 different takes. God, we had blisters and all kinds of stuff. But, yeah, the wall is an ominous thing.
By the way, Pink Floyd, The Wall, is yet another of this year's summer movies. Meanwhile, in An Officer and a Gentleman, Zach's bunkmate, Sid Worley, has his own walls to scale. Sid is played by David Keith.
Sid Worley is the perfect example of the typical upper-middle-class American. He was in a fraternity in college. He, you know, has a girl back home he's engaged to. He's just a very vulnerable kind of guy. You know, he's kind of grown up in a womb, so to speak, of his parents and the church, and, you know, everything's been laid out for him. That's what sets him up for his downfall.
Just listen to this. What if Foley was right? She got herself knocked up just to trap you. Is it still your responsibility? That's not the point. No matter how it happened, there'd still be a child in this world. It'd be mine. I wouldn't know where it was or its name or nothing.
And at the core of An Officer and a Gentleman, Zach's love affair with Paula Pokrifke, portrayed with an immense depth of feeling by Deborah Winger of Urban Cowboy fame. Just as Lou Gossett's drill instructor character helps make Richard Gere a man, so does Deborah.
Deborah's an incredibly talented girl, and has just this light coming out of her, which you see on film. You know, just picks up this magic and confusion and desperately wants to give love and all these things. That's the side of her that she used for this character. She's a very live actress and personality. Things they're not boring around her at all.
So, you got a girl mail to watch?
No. I've been looking for one here.
When are you looking for?
How steamy are the scenes between Richard Gere and Deborah Winger in An Officer and a Gentleman? Well, let's just say that if this were a winter movie, the theaters would still have to be air-conditioned.
I'm not crazy to walk and stand on a set all day with my clothes off. But if you see it as part of the work, you know, this is a positive thing I'm doing. I'm not doing it here because I want everyone to look at me, because there's a reason for it. The reason to have it in the film. There's a reason for it to look right. I have a clause in all of my contracts that I have to have in it.
I still think it was incredible.
I thought so too. Sarah, come on, your fantasy.
What?
No, I'm not gonna get serious on you. I dare you not to fall in love with me. I mean, how can you resist? I'm like candy.
An Officer and a Gentleman. It's the kind of movie you thought they don't make anymore. But thank goodness, they do. It possesses all the ingredients we loved from the movies of the past. But it's a film which truly belongs to today. What director Taylor Hackford describes as a new, old-fashioned movie.
I think Officer and a Gentleman is, if you want to categorize it, a new, old-fashioned movie. And that is that it is contemporary. It's about contemporary mores and about people in today's society. But it hopefully satisfies an audience and satisfies your need for, you know, the old-fashioned type films. It has a beginning, it has a middle, it has an end. There are real characters up there on the screen. There are interrelationships that hopefully are believable. And a story that is satisfying. And, I mean, I say that's old-fashioned, just that those are the kind of values that we always grew up thinking about movies having. And, you know, today that may not necessarily be the case with a lot of movies. I think that hopefully we've tried to do that, and the audience will tell us whether we have or not.
Love, you have it, the Source Summer Cinema Spectacular.
Hi, I'm Steve Spielberg.
Am I glad to see you? Because for all of you who have wondered how so many great movies could be released and accepted in such a short period of time, Steven Spielberg has the answer.
I think there's an elastic marketplace out there because there's room for more than two hits a summer. And Christmas is the same thing. I think there's room for as many hit movies as there are good movies and as there are people who have the wherewithal to go to the movies.
Everyone's gone to the movies. Now we're alone and left. Everyone's gone to the movies. Now we're alone and
left. The Source Summer Cinema Spectacular was written by Alan Daniel Goldblatt. Research consultant Gail Gardner. Produced by Peter Rubenstein, with technical production by Ron Hummel. Executive producer Peter Riches. This has been a production of Riches, Rubenstein, and Radio Incorporated in association with The Source. I'm John Leader. Thanks for listening.
In a career that took him from Indiana farm boy to international legend in 5 years, James Dean.
All right, time travelers, there you go. That was the Source Summer Cinema Spectacular from 1982. An officer of a gentleman, of course, won two Academy Awards. Lou Gossett Jr. won for Best Supporting Actor. And the song Love Lift Us Up Where We Belong won an Academy Award for Best Original Song in the 1983 ceremony. We've played that on this show a number of times. I've only been able to play that particular album once before in the history of my time at WMFO, so I hope you enjoyed that and a look back at the summer that was 35 years ago. Ron Howard, I think is he directing something new now? I don't know. It is WMFO. The Big Picture is coming up at 7 o'clock tonight. Shea Spillane and I will be here to bring you everything you need to know about the world around us, all the fun things that are going on. We've got time for a few more songs before we get out of here, and as I mentioned way, way back at the top of the show, 1982 was a year when a lot of different styles were sort of colliding and coming together. And punk music was alive and well. And one of the best bands, one of my favorite bands of the late 70s, early 80s, and they, of course, evolved into a number of other things over the years and have become a lot of people's favorite bands, is The Jam. And they had a new album out in 1982. So let's listen to what The Jam was up to here on WMFO Medford.
Time is short, and life is cool, but it's up to
Don't like it.
WMFO Medford 91.5 FM. This has been a special edition of Time Travel. We've been parked in the year 1982 and listening to some of the great music that came out that year. We heard The Jam with A Town Called Malice, one of my very, very favorite bands of all time. And we followed that up with Duran Duran, Hungry Like the Wolf. That was the night version of that song. And one of the great things about Duran Duran is some of their singles, at the time when everybody was doing extended dance remixes, were labeled as night versions. And the way that most people did an extended remix is they would take the master tapes, hand them to a producer, and the producer would remix things and isolate things and throw in new beats and extended breaks. Not Duran Duran. Duran Duran would go back into the studio and record more music. They'd record more fills, more solos, more drops, and add that in to extend their songs. So you got additional vocals, additional guitar solos, more drums. They loved what they were doing, and they poured everything into their music, which is awesome. And we close that out with The Clash. That is a song that you remember from the summer of 1982. If you were there, Rock the Casbah was all over the radio all the time. And I've got time for one more as the Blue Box winks out of existence here at WMFO. This was the song of the summer of 1982. You could not turn on the radio without hearing this pretty much every 20 minutes. And I can remember spending an afternoon at a friend's house where we were just on the phone with a local radio station requesting it over and over and over again because we couldn't get enough of it. So as we bid farewell to 1982... and this week's Time Travel, Chris Earle should be back next week. I thank you for letting me take control of the time machine this week. And I hope you'll stick around. We've got On the Town with Mikey D coming up at 9 o'clock tonight. But before that, we've got The Big Picture, everything you need to know about what's happening in the world right now.
Well, ladies, the pleasure was all mine, which is the only thing that matters in the end.
The pleasure was all mine as well. We will see you soon, time travelers. Coming up, the biggest song of the summer of 1982.
About Jack and Diane, two American kids growing up in the heartland. Jackie gonna be a football star, Diane's debutante backseat of Jackie's car. Sucking on chili dog, outside taste freeze. Diane sitting on Jackie's lap, got his hands between his knees. Jackie say, hey Diane, let's run off behind the shady trees. Dribble off those Bobby Brooks, let me do what I please. Say, oh yeah, life goes on, long after the thrill of living is gone. Say, oh yeah, life goes on, long after the thrill of living is gone to walk on. Jackie sits back, flexes thoughts for the moment, scratches his head and does his best James Dean. Well, then there, Diane, gotta run off to city. Diane says, baby, you ain't missing nothing. Jackie say,